Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 8th of September 2018, episode 3, where I'm just reading through, trying to improve my reading skills and give some content and try and process things and also try and remember things. So remember things I've read to research later, or think ahead or process what I've read. The deep briny. Ocean desalination would provide drinking water for all if only you knew what to do with the waste salt. Catherine Borzac reports. That sounds interesting. For the time being, Cape Town has dodged a bullet. After months of unrelenting drought, the recent winter rains have begun to refill its parched dams. Beautifully written. Beautiful, beautiful sentence. That doesn't mean things are easy. City residents are still limited to using 50 litres of water a day, scarcely enough to fill half a bath. As I read that, this is the length of sentences. You've got a long sentence and a short sentence. You probably want two short sentences to really hit. Question. Okay, but now it's this with the conjunction. But at least the so-called day zero, when the taps run dry and the residents have to wait in line to collect survival rations, waters have been diverted. The South African city is an extreme example, but it is far from the only place facing a severe water storage shortage. To slake that thirst, many cities are turning to the ocean, a seemingly inexhaustible supply of water. Yeah, I've got a problem with that statement, because it's either inexhaustible or it is inexhaustible. It is either exhaustible or inexhaustible. They are doing this through desalination, a water purification technology that has been around for decades. Cape Town is bringing a couple of desalination plants online in a hurry, and many others are being built elsewhere. As they spring up, however, attention is focusing on what they leave behind. Concentrated brine, millions of litres of it today. A day. Now, scientists are sounding a note of caution about the impacts of dumping all that salt in the environment. Quote, increasingly, salinity is one of the most important environmental issues of the 21st century, says engineer Amy Childress. But a smaller, this is interesting, she uses a whole lot of buts in this. But smarter methods of desalination are emerging that have benefits far beyond providing clean water. Sao Paulo, Caro, Beijing, Bangalore, the list of cities with water shortages runs long and touches every continent. Even London, often thought as a wet city, only gets about 600 millimetres of rain a year. And will probably have supply problems by 2025. I'm struggling to get fluency here at the moment. As population grows, things are set to get worse. In 2007, the UN found that 1.6 billion people lacked adequate infrastructure to supply them with drinking water. By 2025, the organisation expects that 1.8 billion people, almost a quarter of the world's population, to be living in areas where there is not enough water to sustain them. Ideally, we would meet demand by tapping into stores of fresh waters such as rain-filled reservoirs and rivers, or perhaps groundwater wells, but plenty of places don't have sufficient easily accessible sources of fresh water to support growing populations. One option is to recycle water on a mammoth scale. I must admit that there's a difference between if we go back, there's 1.6 billion lacking adequate infrastructure, and there's 1.8 billion are living in areas where there's not enough water, so it's to sustain them. They're two separate things, they should really be set apart. Another is to turn salty water, like oceans, like the ocean, or brackish lagoons. I will improve. I'm just poor reading at this point in time. That is where desalination comes in, and there are plenty of ways to do it. For example, you can evaporate water from one spot and condense it in another, leaving salt and impurities behind. But the most energy efficient method is reverse osmosis. Imagine a strong salt solution and a weak one, separated by a membrane that allows only water through. In this situation, the water will flow naturally from the weak solution to the strong, evening out the concentrations in the process called osmosis. Well, fundamentally, salt ions attract or compress or pull in water. And so if you've got more, the energy is such that water on average will go to the other side. It's interesting that the body has albumin, a globular protein in the plasma. Most of the protein is that, and that can draw sodium ions, or draw water out of your body. So although you've got a high blood pressure, there's a lower pressure in your cells. Do the reverse, forcing ocean water in high pressure through salt excluding membranes in the opposite direction, you're well on the way to making drinking water. This approach is becoming more common. In 2005, desalination produced 40 billion litres of water daily, according to the International Desalination Association. In 2015, that had increased to 87 billion litres produced by nearly 1,900 plants around the world. This would be actually better put in a graph, I'd say. The vast majority of those are in the dry countries around the Persian Gulf. But the technology's up, is on the up elsewhere too. The Australian city of Adelaide gets roughly half of its water from a huge desalination plant. California, I just have problems with the word huge in there, because it then gets the other parts from smaller desalination plants. California already has a few plants and is spending more than $30 million on 8 new ones. That's about $3 million a plant. That's almost nothing. Dear. Great news. Except about all that brine left behind. It's about as twice as salty as the starting water, depending on the desalination technique used. And most plants dispose of it by pumping it back out to sea. That's a source of concern for researchers, including Childress, who is based in the University of Southern California. The concentration of salts in the sea varies. On average, it's 35 parts per thousand, meaning that every 1,000 grams of seawater, there's 35 grams of salt. Once salt level exceeds what marine plants and animals are used to, there's danger that their cells might cease to work properly. Evidence so far for what happens to life around brine outflows from desalination plants is mixed. In 2012, a study in California State Water Resources Control Board looked at how animals responded to the increased salt concentrations in lab. Conditions. It found that many marine species would probably be fine in increased salinity, but some important ones, like giant kelp, would be at risk. Dense strands of these tall algae form water forests along the Californian coastline. So are kelp algae? That's something I don't understand, because I thought they're vasculated, but we'll just see if I can remember to check that fact out. So kelp is algae. Okay. California coastline, along the California coastline, and their canopies are home to diverse range of species, including sea otters and urchins. Now, this unfortunately requires, at least for the young reader, to understand what those dense kelp forests are like. Giant kelp reproduces most successfully at salinity levels between 25 and 35 parts per thousand, says Mitchell Fosters at California's Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. With the Pacific Ocean salinity already at 35 parts per thousand, any increase might be problematic for kelp and the ecosystems it supports. The Water Control Board study also found that red abalone, a prized edible mollusk, seems to be highly sensitive to salinity increases. Hethi Cooley, Director of Research at the Pacific Institute in Water, in a water think tank, like a water think tank in California, is alert to the unintended consequences of brine disposals. Quote, "We don't really know what the impacts will be on the marine environment," end quote, she says. Cooley has conducted an extensive review of the evidence, for example, looking at the levels of biodiversity and dissolved oxygen before and after the installation of brine outflows from the desalination plants in Perth, Australia, and elsewhere. The results are not easy to interpret and do not necessarily apply everywhere. Wave patterns, for instance, significantly influence brine dispersion, she says. Still, potential risks means most desalination plants must already dilute their brine before discharging it into the ocean. That, in itself, is problematic. The stuff used for dilution is often cleaned up wastewater or water used to cool industrial facilities. It's clean enough to dump in the ocean, but not quite drinkable. That whole procedure is drenched with irony. I like that, drenched with irony. Desalination plants are needed only where there is a lack of fresh water. Yet, they are taking fresh water that could easily be cleaned to make it drinkable, and instead flushing it into the sea. Quote, "Why aren't we reusing that water?" says Cooley. "You're treating it and then dumping it back with desalination brine. It justifies logic. It could well be that the water has poisons for the membranes. I'm not sure. You'd have to understand it a bit more." Childress thinks innovative engineering could stop this. In order to desalinate water, you have to fight against its natural tendency to flow to areas of low to high salt concentration. But if you let nature take its course, allowing flow, allowing forward, not reverse osmosis, it's possible to get more and more water to flow across the salt excluding membrane into the container of brine, increasing that pressure. That pressurized water can be used to drive turbines and generate electricity in a process called pressure retarded forward osmosis, PRFO. My God, it must be a real process. I can't understand that. So that defies logic. If you look at the flow rates, this is just incredibly slow. And the amount of energy stored in high pressure water is nothing compared to that in high pressure steam, because you've got phase changes and expansions. Adding this stage to reverse osmosis desalination plants, you can not only dilute your waste brine, you also get power that you can feed back into the process and use whenever you like. I just find this incredible. So, pressure from the free water into the membrane. And then you get fresh water and you use for water osmosis. Oh, okay, so you, use the fact that fresh water can dilute salt water to generate energy. Okay, I find that hard to see how this works, but it was really good. Hybrid systems like this do not work perfectly yet. I can't see them working at all myself. The first facility opened in 2009 is operated by a Norwegian company, Statkraft, closed after 5 years because it didn't generate enough electricity to building and operating costs. That's exactly what I was thinking. Just in my head, I just can't see it working. Charles is currently modeling a similar system in her lab to see if they can make it more successful. Though the details are under wraps, i.e. that it's stupid. It's the most stupid idea I've ever seen, but I can... There are hopeful signs elsewhere. Neil Tai Sung Chung, a chemical engineer at the National University of Singapore, I think that's a dumb idea. I just can't see... This has got no energy associated with... There are hopeful signs elsewhere. Neil Tai Sung Chung, a chemical engineer at the National University of Singapore, says his lab has developed the technology to a point where it makes economical sense. It comes not a moment too soon for his home country. Quote, "We don't have the energy and we don't have the water," he says. Okay, Singapore could really be... Singapore buys a significant amount of water from its neighbouring Malaysia, but the arrangement is set to expire in 35 years and has long been a political football. Well, to be perfectly honest, I think they should get their water from Malaysia and end of story. Okay, Chung's group set up a test system based on essentially the same idea as Statkraft, but using the team's own improved membranes. And when the researchers ran the setup for 500 hours feeding municipal wastewater and seawater, it powered the consumption of just 1 watt per cubic meter of desalinated water, made a quarter of what it typically needed to reverse the osmosis and reverse osmosis alone. Singapore Research Incubator has taken up the designs and is planning a larger pilot plant. So, it defies logic. So, even then, they only get a 25% increase with all that capital cost. It's ultimate utopia. Some want to take desalination even further. Carry on removing water from brine, and eventually you get pure water and salt. Charles calls it the ultimate utopian desalination process. The technical name for zero liquid discharge is ZLD desalination. Anyone who pulls off the feat will get a threefold rewards. Zero brine, maximum fresh water, and a haul of valuable compounds. In some cases, includes lithium salts, which will provide crucial components for our best batteries. It's amazing how much work has been done on this, Christopher Bologna. Okay, I'm a bit skeptical about this. An environmental engineer at Colorado School of Mines. Chemists have explored mining just about any mineral from brines, uranium, lithium, rubidium, and plain old table salt. But turning briny trash into treasure has never quite hit the big time, principally because the various salts are present in low concentrations and mixes are hard to separate. I think you should have to say magnesium chloride, that's our main source of magnesium, is washing sea salt and getting the magnesium chloride to dissolve off first. I wish they would say that. They There are, however, a few places where economics finally add up. Most deceleration happens at the shoreline, but the US is an exception. Much of the country's groundwater reserves has groundwater reserves that tend to be salty. That's why 95% of desalination plants are inland. With no ocean to discharge to, the waste brine is even more a problem than usual. Most of the time it gets dumped to rivers. Where land is cheap, it might be routed for evaporation ponds, which seems sensible. In Texas and other places with favorable geology, it's injected into deep wells. But all these options have a limited capacity. That's why Arizona is trying to get Mexican permission to build a brine-carrying canal to the sea, so far without success. The largest inland desalination facility in the U.S. is K. Bailey Hutchison Plant in El Paso, Texas. It slakes the thirst of 2.7 million people and injects its brine into deep wells. That is expensive, and the wells will be full before long. A combination that has breathed life into the new ZLD dream. The plant was teamed up with the EnviroWater Minerals of El Paso, and in April, they finished building a brine mining facility inspired by and using some technology from the petroleum industry. The firm's CEO, Hubble Hosman, calls it a water refinery. Just as crude oil can be separated into many valuable products, the facility separates brine into about 5 different streams, eventually extracting nearly all the water and a handful of useful compounds. These include hydrochloric acid, sodium hydroxide, gypsum, magnesium hydroxide, all of which are either used in industry or as a building material. The facility will soon be running at full scale, recovering an additional 7.5 million litres of drinking water a day from the plant. That's actually not much. A million litres of water is a ton. No, it's 1,000. 1,000 litres of water is a ton. Yeah, sorry, 1,000 litres of water is a ton. Not much water. There's also new technology involved, just existing tech in a new combination. Quote, it's a brilliant idea, says Michael Mickey, a hydrologist consultant at Colorado. Whether it makes sense economically is the question. Only time will tell. Logic. Or the treasure trove. Other engineers are looking to turn wastewater into treasure even more challenging conditions. Benny Freeman at the University of Texas in Austin has his eye on oil wells, which extracts 5 times as much water as oil. There's been talk about using the water, but the least expensive thing to do is to pump it back into the ground, he says. Yet, oil well water in Texas contains 1,000 parts per million lithium. Freeman has collaborated with a chemist at Monash University in Australia to develop membranes that can selectively separate the element from water. Even if mining the lithium in this way makes economic sense, Freeman is first to admit that turning his system into a full-scale desalination process would be a challenge. But he says it's an obvious thing to try next. The ZLD dream won't work everywhere, but desalination is a tool that city-state planners need to have ready, says Childress. She says that the only way to solve the problems that come with it is to embrace the diverse set of technologies and pick out the options that work locally. The reason many of these more cutting-edge ideas are not widely used is not that they don't work. Rather, it is we aren't desperate enough yet. Perhaps the lesson from Cape Town is we soon will be. Thanks very much. A very intellectually hard for me to read, disturbing read to get through there. Let's push myself and read the next one, which is an interview. It's called The Surgeon Fixing Scandal. The worst consequences of vaginal mesh could have been avoided if doctors had taken women's report of the pain seriously. Surgeons and campaigners, L. Nell tells Julia Brown. In the late 1980s, the medical industry was looking for new ways to treat women experiencing urinary incontinence and vaginal prolapse. both relatively common conditions following childbirth. At the time, doctors suggested physiotherapy, weight loss, and other non-surgical interventions, with complex surgery as the last resort. When mesh implants came along, they seemed like a simple, convenient alternative. A flexible plastic scaffold that took less than an hour to implant and allowed women to leave hospital quickly and get on with their lives. Permanent mesh implants became standard treatment for millions of women with these conditions. They have proved effective in many cases, but some women have experienced complications including mesh eroding through the vaginal wall and piercing the bladder, nerve damage and infection. Implant can cause chronic pain, sometimes so severe that women are barely able to work. Tens of thousands of women around the world have brought lawsuits. The US Food and Drug Administration reclassified mesh as a high-risk device in 2016. More recently, Australia and New Zealand have banned its use in some circumstances. And in July, the UK's National Health Service suspended the use of the mesh in England for stress incontinence. The mesh was designed to allow bodily tissue to grow through it, so it is very hard to remove. Sola Elnell at the University College Hospital in London is one of the fewer than 10 surgeons in the UK able to carry out the procedure. She performed her first mesh removal in 2005 and since then has been in the forefront of the campaign to raise the awareness of mesh complications. So this is one thing that you can actually go through it. How bad is this situation, is the question. It's a crisis that's probably unprecedented. We still don't know the depth of it. Worldwide, there's 3.7 million meshes we sold between 2005 and 2013. And we still have to monitor patients for the next 15 to 20 years. The complication rate is about 1 in every 10 women who receive the mesh, according to research I was involved with. And that's just for the first 5 years after implantation. We have already limited information we have really limited information on longer term outcomes. But there are indications that complications could be as high as 40% of mesh inserted to treat prolapse. The complications can be serious. Why have doctors been using the material for so long? Originally, the complication rates were deemed to be 1-3%. But this is based on hospital data, where there was no standardized ways to record mesh complication and removal. And these figures don't consider patients who had gone to a family doctor or a pain clinic. Why did you start removing mesh? Women with mesh implants would often come into the chronic pain clinic I ran with colleagues at the University College Hospital in London. We initially focused on using medication and other pain management strategies, but a significant group of patients did not respond. We concluded the only thing would be to try and remove the mesh. Do women's symptoms improve after the mesh removed? In certain patients, things do improve, and generally women are back on track. But pain doesn't always go away. There are long-term consequences even after you have taken the mesh out, including an autoimmune response seen in some people, as well as complex nerve problems affecting the pelvis and lower limbs. How many people in the UK are qualified to insert mesh? Hundreds are qualified to insert it, but relatively few are qualified to remove it. Mine training involved lots of complex vaginal surgery, in particular in women who hadn't really had traumatic childbirth. So my skill sets came from that background. Mesh removal is difficult and occasionally scary surgery. Mesh removal is difficult and occasionally scary surgery. Mesh adheres to the bladder, urethra, vagina, blood vessels, nerves and bones. Once removed, the symptoms of incontinence and prolapse often return. So one needs to consider non-mesh options to restore functionality. That can be difficult in tissue that has been chronically inflamed and inflicted by mesh. Even though others can do removals, I understand women seek you out. My patients were dismissed for a long time, so they lost trust in the doctors. They want someone who will listen to them. There's also a group of women who feel that nobody else can do their surgery.
and there's an element of truth in that. Many surgeons are starting to learn how to deal with the potential surgical complications, but many are still not far enough down the road of experience. You and others face resistance for speaking out against mesh. What do you think is behind that? There's been a great deal of resistance, even anger, from some clinicians, even though the evidence is coming out all the time. I think there's some who believe the media hype and upset, and women have jumped on the bandwagon. And of course, if a surgeon has stopped from using mesh, and they haven't been trained in all the other complex surgical techniques, they cannot offer a surgical option to their patients, so they have no alternative. Some doctors are taking it personally. They fail to recognize that injury isn't to them, injury is to the women. So what's the alternative? Research now shows that over 70% of women with stressed urinary continence who commit to physiotherapy did not need any further intervention. So many clinicians are reverting to conservative measures first before considering surgery. And some are retraining in traditional surgical techniques which existed in the pre-mesh era. How do you feel about the issue from a cultural perspective? It's no longer just a mesh issue or pain issue. It's about the right of access to good health care and belief in women. It's women's rights issue. What makes me angry is the fact that many women affected by complications were not listened to. They were ignored, patronized, and many were sent to psychiatrists or psychologists when there was a problem physical. Some of these women couldn't walk unaided, couldn't function, gave up their jobs, couldn't look after their families. The impact on the quality of life was huge. See, Kwapi, what has happened in the past few years has made me sad because it's affected the way I think about my profession. But occasionally in life, especially in medicine, you must stand up because you have to make people think differently. Is the situation getting better in the UK? Until the recent suspension led by Julie Cumberidge and a team in tandem at the NHS England Department of Health, people were still using continence and prolapse mesh. The suspension meant many have stopped, all but temporarily, but we're just at the tip of the iceberg in dealing with the complication of the mesh already implanted. It's going to get bigger in the years to come globally. I have treated several trainees and colleagues working with me, learning how to do removals, and the women are becoming much more aware. Many women are telling doctors, I'm not having this, thank you very much. The suspension is a good result for women. It's vindication. I expect using mesh will become more difficult from now on. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.